I'd like to begin with a warning this morning. I'm going to be asking questions today. And these are not really normal questions. They're big questions. We're not talking about the weather. They aren't questions that normal, sane, well-adjusted people usually sit down and think about. They're the product of a slightly twisted mind. So if you consider yourself to be normal or sane or well-adjusted, you might want to, like, get comfortable or settle in for a nap or something. But I have faith that God can use twisted minds, too. I just ask you to go along for the ride. There is a point at the end. Trust me. I don't know why you should, but... Okay, I'm talking about cause and effect this morning. Why do you get out of bed in the morning? Why do you do the things that you do? What really makes you tick? What motivates you? Why do you go to work, or why do you stay home? Why does anyone do anything? Do you get out of bed to go earn money so you can buy food? Or do you eat food so that you have the strength to go to work to earn money? Do you work so you can eat, or do you eat so you can work? What's driving you? Is it survival? You want food to eat? Do you want to stay alive? Is it a sense of duty? What makes any of us do anything that we don't absolutely have to do? What's the point? Why is having fun worth the effort? I played a long round of tennis earlier this week. And I came home with blisters on my feet, and I had a sunburn, and I was sore and tired, but I was happy about it. Why? I spend hours making music just for the fun of it, not because I get paid. I hope to get paid someday, but right now it's just because. Look at all the energy that people expend on fun, all of the creative and energetic things we do that aren't really necessary from a survival standpoint. Why do people play golf? What's the draw in whacking a ball around a patch of ground and chasing it down each time to hit it again? Maybe towing around a large bag of heavy clubs with you. Why do we bother to build nice-looking houses? I mean, they're there for a lot more than shelter. Why do we put so much effort into preparing food that looks and tastes good when you can get by with, you know, the nutrition is what you're really after, right? What's the point in all the extra? At Rosedale Bible College's Choral Camp, every year I'm just amazed at the amount of effort and creativity and energy that campers and us staff people pour into the event. Where's all this coming from? What's the cause of creativity and human endeavor and effort? What's the source of all this excess of life and fun? Why do we get out of bed in the morning? Why do we do things we don't have to do? What motivates human behavior? In the scientific world of matter and ideas, there's simple laws of cause and effect that are a lot easier to predict and figure out than human behavior. Scientific laws quantify and categorize how different physical actions are related to each other. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. When a bat hits a ball, the bat causes the ball to fly through the air. The laws of physics are pretty well understood. They're pretty cut and dried. They're predictable. It's cause and effect. Gravity, for instance. Scientists could tell you how fast it was going to fall. They could tell you the rate of acceleration. I'm curious, does anyone know the rate of acceleration off the top of their heads? Oh, okay, yeah. Do you know the meters per second? That's the one I know. There we go. 9.8. One more digit.
3.
1. Nice try. They know how long it'll take for it to reach the ground, how much force it'll have acquired by the time it hits the ground. Galileo proved that heavier objects do not fall faster than lighter objects by dropping two different sized balls off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Isaac Newton, you know about him and gravity. The attractive force between two bodies is proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. We know these things. We're sure of them. Gravity causes objects to be attracted to each other. There's plenty of other examples of physical cause and effect. I remember when I was about 6, I was picking up pecans from the trees in my grandparents' yard, and I discovered to my amazement that if I swung the bucket full of pecans over my head fast enough, the pecans would stay in the bucket, even though the bucket was upside down. It was amazing, and it seemed pretty miraculous. Later, I learned that that's called centrifugal force, and it didn't seem quite so amazing anymore. I understood how it worked. It was cause and effect. My oldest brother, Matt, was and is fascinated by airplanes. I guess it was probably amazing to him that they could overcome gravity. And he learned pretty quickly that planes fly by making use of other physical laws, like lift and thrust and drag. And he studied how it all worked, and he built model planes, and he flew them, and he wrote reports for school about how planes fly. And being the brainy, kind, sensitive older brother that he was, he felt it was crucial to pass that information on to me, whether I felt such knowledge was crucial to my well-being or not. But, yeah, your younger brother, you smile and nod, and you don't get beat up. But most of us get the message at a fairly young age that the world is a predictable place, something we can understand and measure and explain. So in the scientific world, cause and effect seem to be pretty well documented. We know why things happen the way that they do. We've measured the Earth. So much of the technology that we use on an everyday basis is possible because we, or not us, but someone somewhere, has a very sophisticated understanding of cause and effect as it relates to the physical world. Matter and energy behave in predictable ways. We can manipulate it as we choose. We can control it, we can use it, we can change it, shape it, enjoy it. We can cause things to happen. We can bring about the effects that we desire. So we understand science. Now, wouldn't it be nice to be able to figure out those same cut-and-dried laws of cause and effect and apply them to human beings, too? Can we do that? Can we take scientific answers and apply them to questions about human behavior? Do you ever try that with people? If I say such and such, you'll do this. Or how can I manipulate this guy into doing what I want him to do? Maybe your parents are good at this. How well does it work? At The Ohio State University, I attend what is being referred to rather snootily as a major research university. In theory, what this means is that the faculty and students at OSU are applying the scientific method to all of the academic disciplines, seeking new knowledge in every area of life, attempting to quantify and discover and explore, create new connections, discover new causal relationships, more systems of cause and effect. And there's supposed to be groundbreaking research going on in every department, and everybody's supposed to be on the cutting edge of knowledge. That's what it means in theory. In practice, what it means is that me and Andrew and Sam and whoever else is going there get a lot of graduate students teaching our classes while professors are off doing research. Or that we get professors who are brilliant researchers and horrible teachers. Not that, yeah, I'm not bitter about this, but something Andrew and I have discussed a lot on those long nights when we're avoiding our overload of homework given to us by the aforementioned grad students is how strange it can seem to have those theories of scientific cause and effect applied to areas of life where they just don't seem to fit. Psychology, for instance. I had a psych class in which the professor seemed to think of people as machines. You put in a particular event, a particular set of circumstances in childhood, and whammo, you can pre-program a human being the way that you would a computer. For Andrew, there was a communications class that attempted to quantify the human art of conversation with charts and graphs and formulas. There's a definite push at the university to get hard data and numbers and measurements on human relationships. And sometimes psychologists drop the external causes of human behavior and try to explain why we do what we do in terms of our genetic makeup or the way our brains function. And they find a chemical cause to explain our actions and choices. We, in turn, make use of their discoveries. Caffeine gives me my morning buzz and makes me happy. If I ever get depressed, I know there's Prozac. If someday when I'm a school teacher, if I have a hyperactive kid in my classroom, I'll probably be thankful for Ritalin. We live in a heavily scientific age, and we're used to thinking of the world as a very large machine that can be explained in mechanical terms of cause and effect. That's how our society tends to define it. But I think most of us have a kind of instinctive feeling that relationships involving people are not simple matters of cause and effect. So while psychology is interesting and helpful and valid, it can't be the whole story. There's more going on inside our heads than just chemical reactions, right? Right? The text from the Bible today is Colossians chapter 1, starting in verse 15. If there is more going on inside our heads than just chemical reactions, then what is it? Or can science really explain everything for us? Can we really explain the world in terms of cause and effect, or is there more to it than that? Do we really understand it as well as we think we do? Colossians 1, starting verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. In the Bible, we see a radically different explanation of how the world works from the one presented to us by science. This is not a science versus religion sermon. I like science. I like what it does for us. I think it's valuable and good and right to try to understand how the world works. Don't throw any bricks at me. Science is good as far as it goes, but I don't think it tells us the whole story. It not only seems to be incapable of fully explaining human behavior, but I don't think it gets the bigger picture in the natural world either. It says how, but it doesn't say why. Science is based on observation. If you see something happen repeatedly, you infer that there's a scientific law at work. Isaac Newton realized apples seem to always fall to the ground the same way, so he deduced a formula to describe it. But his formula tells us only that there is a force called gravity. It doesn't explain why there is such a force. Why should there be an attraction between these two bodies? Why not a repulsion instead? Why wouldn't apples fly away from the earth or up instead of down? Where's that force come from? Why is it there? We see things happen the same way over and over and over, and so we assume that it's always been like that, and it always will be like that, and that it's just the Earth, this big, massive scientific machine functioning according to fixed laws that never change and never vary. And we take it for granted. Do you see the hand of God in an apple falling from a tree? Do you think as it hits the ground, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together? I don't. I usually just see an apple falling from a tree. Like always, with maybe some vague notion of gravity, if I think of it at all. When you see the sun come up, does it cross your mind that God is involved? Or is it just another day, like always, the sun coming up because the earth is rotating? When you see a flower sprouting from the ground, is it because there's a natural law that says seeds have to grow if you put them in the soil at a certain temperature and the right amount of moisture, because seeds always grow up to be like the plant that produced them? Or is it because God wanted to make something beautiful? I'm not saying it has to be one or the other. I mean, both sides are true, both different ways of explaining this. But I think in our scientifically obsessed society, we often just stop with the scientific explanation. We aren't curious enough. We allow science to rob us of our sense of wonder at the world around us when it should serve to heighten it. It was only centrifugal force that kept my pecans in the bucket. Only? Why would that make it any less amazing or spectacular? Edgar Allan Poe wrote, "Science, meet daughter of old time thou art, who alterest all things with thy peering eyes. Why preyest thou thus upon the poet's heart, vulture, whose wings are dull realities?" Poets typically don't like science very much because it robs them of their imagination. Flowers growing, the sun coming up, it's no big deal. We know how to make flowers grow. We know why the sun comes up, or we know how the sun comes up, because it happens all the time. We know how it works. We don't see the hand of God in it. We don't stop to wonder why it works. We aren't amazed by it. We're surrounded by things that we can't really explain at all, surrounded by amazing events, and because we can give them names like gravity or biology or chemistry or physics, we think they aren't anything special. Kids get it. G.K. Chesterton wrote a passage in his book, Orthodoxy, where he said, by the way, a lot of this is coming from Chesterton's Orthodoxy, where he said, when young children find some game or little joke they enjoy, they always say, do it again. And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun, and every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. The repetition in nature may not be a mere recurrence. It may be a theatrical encore. It isn't that I'm saying science is wrong, but it's important to notice that science is personal. Gravity is the hand of God. And not just the hand of God working way back when, in the dawn of creation, when he wound up the machine and let it go. It's the hand of God right here and now, actively participating in the events of the world, actively sustaining the physical realm we live and move in. We think it's a machine because the sun always rises and sets the same way. But we forget that one day, it didn't. It froze mid-course while Joshua fought a battle. It's not a machine. It operates at God's bidding. We think it's mechanical because it's always the same. You can't walk on water. You can't turn water into wine. You can't walk through walls or rise from the dead. But we forget that there's a man who did do all of those things. God is just as actively involved in sustaining the laws of nature as he was in suspending them. We're amazed that Peter walked on water, a suspension of the laws of nature. But isn't it almost as amazing that God sustains the laws of nature so that we can go swimming in it? We're surrounded by the hand of God, and we miss it because it's so obvious. The implications of this idea, for me, are kind of astonishing. When the apple falls from the tree, God's there? When life stinks, he's not far off. You're not dealing with some cold, impersonal forces of nature. It's not chance that's happening to you. It's a warm, caring, personal God who's intimately concerned with the details of your life and actively involved in everything that's happening to you. I tend to think of prayer as a very impractical mystery, a thing that spiritual people do to please God, while people who want to get things done, practical, business-like people, go out and do them. Is the building project we've been hearing about here at LCF going to happen if we just sit around and pray? What about the prayer team that's going to Thailand? I thought prayer was impractical, a good thing to do, but hey, we know how the world works, and we shouldn't be counting on divine intervention. God helps those who help themselves. But when I begin to think about God being so intimately connected with his world, when I start to realize just how much everything that happens, whether normal or predictable or not, is his doing anyway, my attitude changes. Maybe praying is the most practical thing we can do. Naturally, I think there's a place for both prayer and action, and perhaps the two aren't as far apart as they seem. If God is directly involved with everything that happens, if it's true that he is before all things and in him all things hold together, then divine intervention is not nearly so rare as I would think it was. It's quite literally something that happens all the time, constantly. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. It's a little disconcerting just how dependent this passage makes us. I like to be in control. I like to think that my life, like science, is about cause and effect. I like to think I have influence in the world, that I can cause things to happen the way I want them to, that I can bring about effects that I desire. I like to think I can apply cause and effect to my spiritual life, too. If I behave a certain way, God has to respond. If I want the Spirit in my life, all I've got to do is pray the right prayer and be holy enough, and he's mine. It's just a matter of figuring out the formula and how the system works, and then I can control my relationship with God. I started by asking, where does our motivation come from? But many times, I find myself asking the reverse question. Sitting at my desk, staring at my homework in its fat, ugly face, and instead of asking where my motivation came from, I'm asking where it went. I'm pretty shocked at just how fragile my grip on life is. I'm used to being successful at most things I try. I'm used to being creative. I'm used to waking up in the morning feeling good about life and knowing I've got a good reason to get out of bed. But lately, I've been made keenly aware that those attitudes and abilities were never really under my control. My ideas, my drive, my creativity, my desire to accomplish, for that matter, my desire to serve God and love and serve those around me, it doesn't come from me. We just finished finals at OSU this week, and there's nothing like finals week to drive home the point that I can't force myself to care. I can't really control my own life. I can't be good or accomplish anything worthwhile. I can't be creative. I can't have fun. I can't motivate myself. I can't come up with a satisfying reason to get out of bed in the morning. In point of fact, I can't breathe or exist without God's hand sustaining me. The point. Here's the point. Life is a gift. It's something we don't deserve. We're fallen, sinful people. We're cut off from God, and no amount of trying harder, no amount of self-motivation, no amount of cause and effect, no amount of duty or whipping yourself into shape can ever really give you something worth living for or worth getting out of bed for. But God gives us a way, through Jesus, to be reconciled back to him, to be restored to that life-giving connection. And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. It's the grace of God that gives us the desire to get up in the morning, our desire to have fun, our ability to enjoy life, to live and to love and to care. God's creative and fun-loving, and he takes delight in giving us the ability to be creative and to have fun as we're made in his image. Reading on, verse 21. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. If you continue in your faith, established and firm, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. Now I rejoice in what was suffered for you, and I fill up in my flesh what was still lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, which is the church. I have become its servant by the commission of God, by the commission God gave me to present to you the word of God in its fullness, the mystery that has been kept hidden for ages and generations, but is now disclosed to the saints. To them God has chosen to make known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. We proclaim him, admonishing and teaching everyone with all wisdom, so that we may present everyone perfect in Christ. To this end I labor, struggling with all his energy, which so powerfully works in me. Paul makes it a point to explain that he's working with God's energy, not his own. And he also took care to point out that this gift of God in our lives is a mystery, Christ in you, the hope of glory. Not something that we can explain with cause and effect or take control of or be in charge of. In the next chapter, Paul even briefly warns the Colossians about taking human reasoning and human effort too far. He says, "See that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and basic principles of this world rather than on Christ." Our motivations, our loves and desires and hopes and dreams are gifts from God that we neither understand nor deserve, things we cannot earn and for which we can only be thankful. And the wonderful excess of energy and creativity in the world around us, both in the natural world and in the lives of people we meet, created in God's image, is a gift meant to be enjoyed. So, just in case you were wondering why you get out of bed in the morning, now you know.